very excited to bring to the stage Joost van Drunen, the CEO of SuperData. Joost and I have been working together for 10 years, I think. He studied the game in video games. He is one of the go-to people for data, so much so that he built SuperData, and now it is now a Nielsen company. So here to present brand new data on kids, tech, and games. I don't know about you guys, but I have a 7 and 8 year old, and Minecraft is hot, but Fortnite is really kind of knocking on the door.
Thank you. So thanks for coming, thanks for listening, and thanks for having me, obviously. Tonda and I, as you mentioned, we've been working together for a while. It's always a great moment for me to kind of speak about specifically the segment where kids are involved. For the very selfish reason that I'm a dad, my child is almost 6, going on 13, and so in many ways for me it's always kind of an interesting lens, right? For the longest time I've been thinking about the world very selfishly as a gamer, as someone who's really into interactive entertainment, and so taking on this new perspective and being part of the discussion with a crowd like this is always very fascinating for me. The picture here, I guess this was after I shaved. I set up a company 8 years ago to basically track digital entertainment, and starting with video games. Video games in many ways are sort of a vanguard in terms of entertainment. What we see there tends to translate into principles that we see everywhere else. I will explain this in more detail. 8 years ago, we started to look at video games from a digital perspective, digital distribution, microtransactions, et cetera. The games industry wasn't ready for that. They didn't see that as something that was very relevant to their revenue streams or interesting from a design perspective. Over time, that's changed. So over the last 2 decades or so, I've been both looking at interactive entertainment as an academic as well as a commercial researcher. And as Tonda already mentioned, so a few months ago, Nielsen acquired my company, which is a lot of fun because now I have even more data to sink my teeth into, and I look forward to kind of building that out as well, of course. The thing to know is I have about 40 slides and 18 minutes on the clock, so I hope you had some coffee. We'll get it started. I'm noticing that my formatting is broken a little bit, so we'll see what it does. I will distribute the slides freely. You can get in touch with me if you want to see the deck. So, you know, everything that's in there, I will be able to share with you guys. These are the 5 things. So I'm going to do a very simple perspective. I'm going to take 5 games, and I'm going to tell you some of the principles behind them and how I believe that those are going to be the drivers of change, particularly when it comes to technology relevant to children and younger audiences. To this crowd, it's probably not an unfamiliar story, but most of the people I talk to, like game publishers and financial investors, they find it kind of hard to believe that there was a moment in not too long ago when everybody and his mother had this sort of toy in their hand that was $5 on the street in Chinatown. Everybody could just build one and sell one. It was unlicensed, and it was very counter-cyclical or counterintuitive to the traditional way that toy companies and retailers operate, right? Rather than having an incredibly slow and long cycle from design to, you know, going all the way down to the value chain to deal with manufacturing and then marketing, trying to pitch things as the new toy to have, suddenly these fidget spinners just kind of broke the mold and basically became the thing that no one saw coming. So in that same context, we see then toy retailers basically suffering the brunt of this. Of course, there's a larger story here, but it didn't help that they were kind of swinging and missing on a lot of this stuff. And so whenever I stand in front of American audiences, as well as my class at NYU, this is sort of the part where people wince. They go, ooh, I used to go there. It was so much fun with my parents. I'd get a toy on the weekends. And now it's basically this sort of decline of traditional retail. So that's largely the metaphor for what's happening in the games industry in general. When we look at entertainment on a high level, we have sort of these key moments in the history. Over the last 30 years of data, you see, you know, the introduction and popularization of broadband connections. Everybody has the internet. Everybody has a big enough pipe to download all that stuff to their house, their home, their phones. And then, of course, the introduction of the iPhone in 2007. Apple rewrote the book single-handedly on how we consume entertainment. And so those are 2 key moments in sort of the overall history of entertainment. If you look at the different categories, then suddenly you realize, like, okay, well, some of them suffered greatly. Newspapers, magazines have a hard time, you know, sort of reinventing their revenue models. Others do fairly well. They sort of stay flat, so they go, you know, fine year over year. But games is really the big winner in this context. But there's something about games that makes it so that they continue to thrive even as other entertainment categories suffer. If you organize it by different sort of consumer patterns or different ways that we consume entertainment, watching kind of flat there, reading take a big dip, and then listening while it's doing finer towards the end because of the introduction of new technologies and companies like Spotify gaining popularity, playing is really a growth category for a lot of consumers. So the instinct to play, in my mind, is this interesting topic of conversation purely because it's a universal thing, right? Sort of irrespective of historical moment or of cultural context, everybody plays. And that has everything to do with the fact that we're sort of hardwired to figure out the world around us by looking at things in a sort of play form, in a playful format. So the best way to understand that relationship with regards to technology is to go back to Windows 95. And, you know, everybody will remember Minesweeper and Solitaire. And of course, the reason this game was on there, these games were on there, wasn't because Microsoft thought they were fun. This was, we were learning how to use a mouse for the first time, right? For the first time ever, people had to interface with like a graphical user interface, and they had to figure out what it was to double click things. They had to figure out what it was to drag and drop things. Things that are totally, you know, obvious to us today, at the time were not. And so in a very playful way, they familiarized us with how to use the new technologies. So in that same vein, I want to talk a little bit then about what is it that, you know, the titles of today that are very popular tell us about the future or the current state of technology. So the first one is Angry Birds. Angry Birds follows that same exact model, right? It's the moment where everybody had a fancy new glistening iPhone in their hands, wondering like, how do I use this? And one of the big innovations was the interface. You'd end up basically dragging and dropping things, right? The touchpad interface was a sort of radical new idea, and it was very intuitive, but you had to learn how to do it, right? That sort of way to catapult the birds, that showed you how to do it. Not only that, it became then, of course, a model that everybody wanted to emulate in terms of revenue. The revenue model, if you remember behind Angry Birds, was the game is free, but you can pay $1, $1.99, and then you get more levels, et cetera, et cetera. So if you look at it from an industry perspective and sort of, you know, where the money goes in terms of, you know, an incentive to design things and technological innovation around it, the product-based business started to change. So you see over the last 30 years in the games industry specifically, a sort of, you know, growth pattern you can identify probably around 2007, the introduction of the Wii, very successful console, did really, really well at retail. There's a, you know, tried and true model in terms of the product category, and that will continue to do well. The growth in the games industry, however, has come from the service business. And this is where Angry Birds sort of exemplifies that thinking. Here we have a game that's free, it teaches you about a new technology, but it also teaches and it sort of familiarizes you with a new revenue model. Suddenly, we were much more attuned to spending no money or very little money on having these great experiences and playing for a long time. A lot of people were worried about this, of course. They said, well, here we have this free stuff, this free content. How will this make us money? Over time, this is exactly where all the growth came from. This is how the industry sort of started to evolve. The second game, then, is Minecraft. If you don't know Minecraft, then you're in the wrong room. But, you know, it really comes down in my mind and in my household to figuring out, you know, what it is that this game allows you to do. Is it about sort of like a digital Lego? Yeah, not really. It's really about a customization and a personalization of technology, right? If we are supposed to learn how to use things and figure out new technologies, the best way is to kind of have them reflect back at us, right? To sort of establish a connection. So in the same way that Netflix allows me to set up a profile that then attunes the algorithms to my tastes and preferences, or the same way that Spotify does so well by allowing me to build playlists around my favorite music, and I can name it anything I want, I can share it with anybody, and sort of it becomes not just a thing that I do in my own little world, it's something that I share with others. It becomes not just a personalization and customization, it becomes an expression of myself. So this now is then the big moment for Minecraft. Kids don't use games just to play and sit in a sandbox and kind of sit in their own world as much as they do it as a form of expression. And that becomes then this much larger form of engagement. Minecraft has a conference around it annually called MineCon, and it draws all these people and all these parents and all these kids in just to kind of share with others this love for this particular game that they have. So it's not just a technology between me and the box and that experience, it's really the much larger sort of cultural moment and the social experience that we share. Of course, you see this now also on the interwebs. So YouTube, you know, has a tremendous amount of Minecraft content. And what that really amounts to is that these audiences that are now very, very young, they grow up with this idea that they watch things on the internet. And it's homemade, it's user-generated, it is based around something that they share, that they go and visit out there. Very, very different media model than before, and very, very different technology underlying all of this. So gaming video content to us is a large category that's growing, and what's driving it is the sort of affinity and the appetite coming from younger audiences. Number three, Minions. In this particular game, Despicable Me 2, Minion Rush, made by Glu Mobile, I believe. This is one of the moments where things don't seem to go so well, right? If the previous two examples are sort of about, hey, this is great, technology is evolving, isn't all this innovation cool? This one is a little bit different. So again, as the parent, so this is a picture of my kid from a few years ago. You know, I'm sure that you share your sort of sense of, I have to be responsible, I got to teach him the right way. And here's this inevitable iPad in his life, in his world, in his life, and I have to figure out how to deal with that. So we're all familiar with the sticker boards. Like, you do your chores, you get a sticker, you get enough stickers, you get a toy, you get a piece of candy. That works beautifully for my kid. And so this is obviously a principle that works really well, I think, across most childhoods. Where it kind of breaks down for me is exposing kids too aggressively and too early on to these sort of really sort of predatory monetization models. So this is an example. It's not so much predatory in that they're trying to shake you down. It is way too confusing. As a parent, as a lazy parent, the second I put him behind a game, I expect him to kind of just have fun for a little bit, not ask a bunch of questions about what does this mean and how many bananas go into a banana vacuum and do I have to watch this ad and is this ad properly targeted to my game and to my child? All of those things kind of fall to the wayside. So here we see a disconnect in terms of technology, and here we see a moment and an instance of a publisher kind of swinging and missing on what should really be a mega, mega franchise, but executing it in a sort of old-fashioned or sort of inappropriate way. What makes sense then, of course, in response to this is that a platform like Apple says, you know what, free-to-play might not work for everybody. We should have categories that basically allow this to be more efficient. So they have pay once and play, where you just buy the game and you're done, right? The sort of old-fashioned premium revenue model where you pay a couple of bucks and that's it. There's no more asking for money down the line. And this is, of course, a great category for kids as well as for parents. And you see titles like from the Toca Boca series do really, really well on this character. It's really about exploration, it's uninterrupted fun, you can play as much as you like, and you don't really have to worry about sort of the world around there in terms of monetization and other questions. Number four, Pokemon Go. So another one of these that I spend most of my career talking about, at least the last few years. It's very interesting. So I'm a Dutchman, I left the Netherlands because the food is terrible and the weather is worse. And so I find myself 2 years ago, suddenly talking to the reporters, and they're showing me this picture. This is a picture not too far from where I grew up, where thousands of people were looking for Pokemon in the dunes of the Netherlands, right? And everybody was upset because they were trampling the nature of it all, and it was this interesting moment. Most of all, what this brought to the foreground, to sort of the mainstream news media, was that suddenly games were out there, right? They were in public, they were in public spaces, they were in the middle of the city. My office, not too far from Central Park, was just mobbed by just thousands of people looking for Pokemon everywhere. And it wasn't so much that it was a fad and that the game was interesting or not. Who kind of cares about that? What's interesting in my mind is that suddenly, where gaming used to be this fringe activity that weird people do in their parents' basement and be covered in Cheeto dust, suddenly is this thing that sits like out there in public and everybody knows about it. And so now it's a form of expression, but it's also something that we share socially and much broader culturally. So what that does then is now we have a conversation going. Now we have a really interesting take on traditional things like discovery, right? In a digital environment, in an infinite inventory, ostensibly, you could find things as long as the algorithms are good enough. In a traditional setting like GameStop, like you walk in, what do I buy? What's the best deal for my money? That model, just like Toys R Us, isn't working so well for a variety of reasons, but most of all, of course, the digital has taken over and is offering different solutions. What's interesting about the kids segment in that context is that, as they play, they don't just go to the store and like run search queries, they go to their buddies. So Pokemon has a long history of being something that's very portable, that fits in your pocket, that is very universal, And that allows people to kind of socialize, right? It's a card deck that you sit at the playground, you play with your 12-year-old buddies. It's a really fun experience, but it also allows you to kind of share with others and like talk about the game and do things like that. So in terms of, you know, how do kids find out about this stuff, they learn from each other, right? So when it comes to Minecraft, when it comes to Fortnite, it's so sad, I had such beautiful formatting. Anyways, when it comes to those games, you see this young category is the most aware of things without any help from us as advertisers and marketers, right? They know instinctively because they have this little social network and they all talk about it, right? And there's a tremendous amount of commercial power behind these kids sort of driving the success of titles like this. And then number five, and really it's the big one lately, Fortnite is really the big ticket, you know, well on its way to make $2.5 billion a year that maybe we as industry people might know about. But imagine the surprise of my mother-in-law as she's watching her favorite daytime TV show, and suddenly there's some kid with blue hair talking about some gobbledygook video game. What? And his name is Ninja? Is this some kind of, you know, some kind of circus act? No, this is a millionaire who spends his time 12 hours a day broadcasting on Twitch and, you know, basically having a great time playing a game, doing it with celebrities and other people, and bringing this into the mainstream. And so if we look at the metrics for some of this, you see here Fortnite in the orange, some of the other major titles on a platform like Twitch where you have, you know, hundreds of millions of people watching every day, hour after hour, you know, other people play video games. You see a game like Fortnite break out of it. This has everything to do, of course, with the fact that it's a good game, it's a fun game, it's well developed and designed. But Ninja in this case also had the, you know, unaided help of musician Drake, and that kind of pushed it into the mainstream, and suddenly Fortnite became this overnight success where it's been in development for a decade, which most people don't know. Suddenly you find that this is a very popular thing. What that does and what it accomplishes is not just that we talk about it as a sort of cultural artifact where we say, oh, that's so cool, or the gameplay is interesting in a way. What's fundamentally different about this game that no other game is really has accomplished at this scale is to get all of the major platform companies to play nice together, right? So imagine a world where previously, you know, like the telecom business, you would never be able to, you know, make only phone calls on the Verizon network. Of course you can talk to anybody else on any other network, right? So the telecom providers, they get that. The walled gardens of the console business, they don't. They're still figuring that out. And so here now is a game that is so successful and it has so much to offer in terms of network effects and sort of just the joy of playing that you have an entire generation that are going to grow up where cross-play or interoperability between platforms is sort of a given and not some exception. And that's not just for Fortnite. You see it here also with Roblox. As Roblox goes from PC to console to mobile, you know, suddenly you find that it's doing really well and it builds all these network effects in. So you can expect the future for a lot of game design, a lot of the technology specifically targeted at this audience to keep tabs on or to have an eye out for the ability to be cross-platform enabled. So that's the summary of them. We have this emergence of new revenue models. We have this sort of games as a service model that's much more difficult to understand for traditional publishers than you'd think, but it's very, very profitable. We have a lot of course, self-customization of the content, and it becomes a form of expression. I don't know why there's so many typos in there. I'm really smart, I swear. I spell checked it. I fired interns over this kind of stuff. So subscriptions are a very sort of obvious model. So now that games are mainstream, we can buy by the bundle rather than by the item. Of course, this is also to some degree, a lot to do with the fact that tech companies and entertainment companies, they figured out that recurrent subscription revenue gets a much higher valuation if you're publicly traded than when you just do a transactional model and you get valued for EBITDA. Changes in discovery is very different. It's much more sort of the crowdsourced, helping each other understand things, you know, building the algorithms, but there has to be a human involved to kind of give it a little bit of zhuzh to kind of help people understand these things better and find the things that are really relevant to them. And of course, interoperability. So those are five big drivers of the change in technology that we've observed in the games business when it focuses on children. And I'm happy to hear more of your questions and welcome to the conversation and discussion. My name is Joost. Thank you for your time.